get us out of the neighborhood, if they could. You see the man opposite Clayton in the circle? The one with the patch over his eye? Marsh looked and nodded. He was caught walking from the bus stop back to the center after coming from his job. Caught by the local gang, the T-Dub Boys. They put his eye out with a broken bottle. Bosch turned back to her. He knew she was referring to a Latino gang from up around the Tujunga Wash. Latin gangbangers were notorious for their intolerance and violence towards sexual deviants. Anyone get arrested for it? She laughed derisively. To make an arrest, there would have to be an investigation. But you see, none of the vandalism or violence around here ever gets investigated by your department or anyone else. Bosch nodded without looking at her. He knew the score. Now, if there are no other questions, I need to get back to work.
No, no more questions, Bosch said. Go back to your good work, Doctor, and we'll go back to ours.
Chapter 9. Bosch had just gotten back to the PAB from the Hall of Records with a stack of files under his arm. It was after 5, so the squad room was almost deserted. Chu had gone home, which was fine with Bosch. He planned to leave himself and to start reviewing files and the disc from the Chateau Marmont at home. He was loading the files into a briefcase when he saw Kiz Ryder enter the squad room and make a beeline in his direction. He quickly snapped the briefcase closed. He didn't want Ryder asking about the files and learning that they were not from the Irving case.
Harry, I thought we were going to keep in touch, she said by way of greeting.
We are going to when I have something to keep in touch about. Hello to you, too, Kiz.
Look, Harry, I don't really have time for niceties. I'm under pressure from the chief, who is under pressure from Irving, and the rest of the city council members he has managed to get behind this.
Get behind what?
Wanting to know what happened to his son.
Well, I'm glad you're there to shoulder that burden and keep it off the investigators so we can do our work.
She let out a deep breath in frustration. Bosch could see the jagged edge of a scar on her neck just under the collar of her blouse. It reminded him of the day she got shot, her last day as his partner. He stood up and lifted the briefcase off the desk.
You're leaving already? She exclaimed.
Bosch pointed to the clock on the far wall. Almost 5:30 and I punched in at 7:30. I ate lunch for 10 minutes on the hood of my car. No matter how you cut it, I got in about 2 hours of overtime that the city doesn't pay anymore. So yeah, I'm going home, to where I have a sick kid waiting for me to bring her some soup. That is, unless you want to call up the city council and see if they'll authorize.
Harry, it's me, Kiz. Why are you acting like this?
Like what?
Like I'm fed up with the political intrusion on my case?
Tell you what, I've got another one working. A 19-year-old girl raped and left dead on the rocks at the marina. The crabs got to her body. It's funny, but nobody on the city council has called me up about that one.
Kiz nodded to his point.
I know, Harry, it's not fair. With you, everybody counts or nobody counts. That doesn't work with politics.
Bosch stared at her for a long moment. She quickly grew uncomfortable.
What?
It was you, wasn't it?
It was me what?
Everybody counts or nobody counts.
You turned it into a slogan and you told it to Irving. Then he tried to act like he'd known it all along.
Ryder shook her head in frustration.
Jesus Christ, Harry, what's the big deal?
His front man called up and said, who is the best investigator in RHD? I said you, but then he came back and said Irving didn't want you because of your shared history. I said you would put the history aside because with you, everybody counts or nobody counts. That's all. If that's too political for you, then I offer my resignation as your friend.
Bosch looked at her for a few moments. She was half smiling, not taking his upset seriously.
I'll think about it and let you know.
He stepped out of his pod and headed down the aisle.
Wait a minute, would you?
He turned back to her.
What?
If you're not willing to talk to me as a friend, then talk to me as a detective. I am a lieutenant, and you are a detective. What is the update on the Irving case?
Now the humor in her face and words was gone. Now she was annoyed.
The update is that we're waiting on the autopsy. There was nothing about the physical scene that leads us to any final conclusion. We have pretty much eliminated accidental death. It's going to go suicide or murder, and my money at the moment is on suicide.
She put her hands on her hips.
How has accidental already been eliminated?
Bosch's briefcase was heavy with files. He switched it to his other hand because his shoulder was beginning to ache. Almost 20 years before, he had taken a bullet during a shootout in a tunnel, and it had taken 3 surgeries to repair the rotator cuff. He had gone almost 15 years without its bothering him. But not anymore.
I already told Irving most of this. His son checked in without luggage. He took off his clothes and hung them neatly in the closet. A bathrobe was draped over a chair on the balcony. He went down face first, but didn't scream because no one in the hotel heard a thing. He did not put his arms out to break his fall. For these and other reasons, it doesn't look like an accident to me. If you are telling me that you need it to be an accident, then come out and say it, Kiz, and then get yourself another boy. Her face showed the pain of his betrayal.
Harry, how can you say that to me? I was your partner. You saved my life once. And you think I would repay you by putting you into something that would compromise you?
I don't know, Kiz. I'm just trying to do my job here, and it seems like there's a lot of high jingo on it.
There is, but that doesn't mean I haven't been watching out for you. The chief told you he wasn't looking to cook the book on this. I'm not either. All I wanted was an update, and now all of this bile comes out.
Bosch realized his anger and frustrations were misdirected. Kiz, if that's the way it is, then I believe you, and I'm sorry to take it out on you. I should have known anything with Irving attached was going to go this way. Just keep him off of me until we get an autopsy. After that, we'll be able to draw some conclusions, and you and the chief will be the first to know.
Okay, Harry. I'm sorry, too.
Talk to you tomorrow.
Bosch was about to step away when he changed direction and came back to her. He gave her a one-armed hug. Are we okay? She asked.
Sure, he said.
How's your shoulder? I saw you switch hands with your case.
It's fine.
What's wrong with Maddie?
She's got a bug, that's all.
Tell her I said hi.
I will. See you, Kiz.
He left her then and headed home. As he moved in slow traffic on the 101, he wasn't feeling good about either of the cases he was working, and he was upset that those feelings had made him act poorly with Ryder. Most cops would cherish having an inside source in the OPC. At times, he certainly had. But he had just treated her badly and had no legitimate excuse. He would have to make it up to her. He was also bothered by Dr. Stone and the way he had arrogantly dismissed her cause. In many ways, she was doing more than he was, trying to stop crimes before they happened, trying to save people from becoming victims. He had treated her like a sympathizer of the predators, and he knew that was not the case. It was a city where not enough people cared about making it a better and safer place to live. She did, and he had dismissed her. Shame on me, he thought. He pulled his phone and called his daughter's cell.
You doing okay?
Yeah, I'm feeling better.
Did Ashlyn's mom check on you?
Yes, they both came by after school and brought me a cupcake.
That morning, Bosch had emailed her best friend's mother to ask for the favor. Did they bring you your homework?
Yes, but I'm not feeling that much better. Did you get a case? You never called today, so I'm thinking you did.
Sorry about that. Actually, I got 2 cases.
He noted her skill in changing the subject from homework.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm going to be a little late. I've got one more stop, and then I'll be home. You want soup from Jerry's Deli? I'm going to be up in the valley.
Chicken noodle.
You got it. Make a sandwich if you get hungry before I get back. And make sure the door's locked.
I know, Dad.
And you know where the Glock is?
Yes, I know where it is, and I know how to use it.
Okay, that's my girl. He closed the phone. Chapter 10. It took him 45 minutes in rush hour traffic to get back to Panorama City. He cruised by the Buena Vista apartments and saw lights on behind the shaded windows he believed belonged to the office he had been in earlier. He also saw a driveway on the side of the building that led to a fenced parking area in the rear. There was a no trespassing sign on the gate, and it was topped with barbed wire. At the next corner, he turned left and soon came to an alley that would take him behind the row of apartment buildings that fronted Woodman. He came to the fenced parking lot behind the Buena Vista and pulled to the side of the alley next to a green trash bin. He surveyed the well-lighted lot and noted the 8-foot security fence that surrounded it. It was topped with 3 strands of barbed wire. There was a walk-through gate for accessing the trash bin, but it was padlocked and also topped with barbed wire. It appeared to be a fully secured compound. There were only 3 cars in the lot, but one was a white 4-door with what looked like paint damage on its side. He studied the car and soon realized the damage was actually fresh paint. A bad match of flat white paint had been sprayed on the driver's side doors to cover the graffiti. He knew it was Dr. Stone's car and that she was still at work inside. He noted that graffiti had also been painted over all along the back wall of the building. A ladder was leaning against the wall next to a door marked with the same sort of warning signs he had seen up front earlier in the day. Bosch turned off his car and got out. 20 minutes later, he was leaning on the back of the white car in the lot when the rear door of the apartment building opened and Dr. Stone emerged. She was escorted by a man, and they both stopped short when they saw Bosch. The man took a protective step in front of Stone, but then she put her hand on his arm.
"It's okay, Rico. He's the detective who was here earlier."
She continued walking toward her car. Bosch stood up straight. "I didn't mean to scare you. I just wanted to talk to you." This last part slowed her down as she considered it. She then turned to her escort.
"Thank you, Rico. I'll be all right with Detective Bosch. I'll see you tomorrow."
"You sure?"
"Yes, thank you."
"See you tomorrow."
Rico headed back to the door and used a key to open it. Stone waited until he was back in the building before addressing Bosch.
"Detective, what are you doing? How did you get back here?"
"I got back here the same way the gangbangers with the paint did. You have a security problem." He pointed through the fence to the green trash bin. "Kind of defeats the purpose of the fence when you have a dumpster pushed up against it like that. Gives them a climbing platform. If I could get over at my age, it would be a piece of cake for those 15-year-olds. Her mouth opened slightly as she looked at the fence line and the obvious dawned on her. She then looked at Bosch.
"You came back just to check the security of our parking lot?"
"No. I came back to apologize."
"For what?"
"The attitude. You're trying to do a good thing here, and I acted as though you were part of the problem. I'm sorry for that." She was clearly taken aback.
"I still can't tell you about Clayton Pell."
"I know. That's not why I'm here. I'm already punched out for the day." She pointed to the Mustang on the other side of the fence.
"Is that your car? How are you going to get back to it?"
"It's mine. Now, if I were a TW boy, I'd take that ladder you've conveniently provided and climb back over. But climbing in was enough for me. I'm hoping you'll just unlock the padlock on that gate and let me out." She smiled, and it was disarming. A few strands of her carefully pulled back hair had come loose and were framing her face. Unfortunately, I don't have a key to that gate. I wouldn't mind seeing you make that climb, but why don't I just drive you around?
Sounds good.
He got into the passenger side of her car, and they drove out through the gate and on to Woodman.
Who is Rico? Bosch asked.
He's our overnight orderly, Stone said. Works 6 to 6.
Is he from the neighborhood?
Yes, but he's a good kid. We trust him. Anything happens or anybody acts up, he calls me or the director right away.
Good.
They came down the alley and she stopped behind his car. The problem is the trash bin is on wheels, she said. We can push it away from the fence, but they can push it right back.
Can't you expand that gate and keep it inside the compound?
If we put that in the budget, we'll probably get it approved in about 3 years.
Bosch nodded. Every bureaucracy was in budget crisis. Have Rico take the lid off the dumpster. Then they'll have nothing to stand on. It might make a difference. She nodded.
Might be worth a try.
And keep having Rico walk you out.
Oh, I do, every night.
He nodded and put his hand on the door handle. He decided to go with his instincts. He had seen no ring on her finger.
Where's home from here? North or south?
Oh, south. I live in North Hollywood.
Well, I'm heading to Jerry's Deli to pick up some chicken noodle soup for my daughter. You want to meet me there and maybe get something to eat?
She hesitated. He could see her eyes in the dim light from the dash. Detective.
You can call me Harry.
Harry, I don't think that would be such a good idea.
Really? Why?
I'm talking about a quick sandwich. I have to bring soup home. Well, because... She paused and then started laughing.
What?
I don't know. Never mind. Yes, I'll meet you there.
Good, then I'll see you in a few minutes.
He got out of the car and headed to his own. The whole way to Jerry's, he kept checking the rearview mirror. She was following him, and he half expected her to suddenly take a screaming turn to the left or right when she changed her mind. But she never did, and soon they were sitting across from each other in a booth. In the well-lighted deli, he noticed her eyes for the first time. There was a sadness in them he had not noticed before. Maybe it was from the work. She dealt with the lowest form of human life, the predators, those who took advantage of the smaller and the weaker, those the rest of society couldn't stand to look at.
How old is your daughter?
15 going on 30.
She smiled. She's home sick from school today, and I barely got the chance to check in on her. It's been a busy day.
It's just you and her?
Yes, her mother, my ex, died a couple years ago. I went from living alone to trying to raise a 13-year-old. It's been interesting.
I bet.
He smiled. The truth is, I've loved every minute of it. It's changed my life for the better. I just don't know if she's better off.
But there's no other choice, is there?
No, that's the thing. She's stuck with me.
I'm sure she's happy, even if she doesn't express it. It's hard to read teenage girls.
Yeah.
He checked his watch. He felt guilty now that he had put himself first. He wouldn't get home till at least 8:30 with the soup. The waiter came and asked for their drink order, and Bosch told him that they needed to order everything to save time. Stone ordered half of a turkey sandwich. Bosch ordered a whole turkey sandwich and the to-go soup.
What about you? He asked when they were left alone.
Stone told him she had been divorced for over 10 years and had had only one serious relationship in the time since. She had a grown son who lived up in the San Francisco area, and she rarely saw him. She was pretty much dedicated to her job at the Buena Vista, where she had worked for 4 years, after a midlife change in direction. She went from being a therapist who specialized in treating narcissistic professionals
to retooling for a year in school before treating sex offenders. Bosch got the idea that her decision to change her professional life and work with the most hated members of society was some sort of penance, but he didn't know her well enough to go further with his suspicion. It was a mystery he would have to wait to solve, if he got the chance.
"Thank you for what you said back in the parking lot," she said. "Most cops, they just think these people should be taken out and shot."
"Well, not without a trial." He smiled, but she didn't see the humor in it.
"Every one of these men is a mystery. I'm a detective like you. I try to find out what happened to them. People aren't natural-born predators. Please don't tell me you believe that."
Bosch hesitated. "I don't know. I sort of come in after the fact to clean things up. All I know is that there is evil out there in the world. I've seen it. I'm just not sure where it comes from."
"Well, my job is to find that out. Find out what happened to these people that put them on this path. If I can find it out, I can help them. If I help them, then I'm helping the cause of society. Most police don't get that. But you, what you said tonight, I think maybe you do."
Bosch nodded, but felt guilty about what he was hiding from her. She read it right away.
"What aren't you telling me?"
He shook his head, embarrassed at the easy read. "Listen, I want to level with you about today." Her stare turned hard. It was as though she realized the dinner invitation had been some sort of a setup. "Wait, it's not what you're thinking. I didn't lie to you today, but I didn't tell you the whole story about Pell. You know the case I'm working, with Pell's DNA on the victim? It's 22 years old." The suspicion on her face was quickly replaced with bewilderment. "I know," he said. "Doesn't make sense. But it is what it is. His blood was found on a girl murdered 22 years ago."
"That would have made him 8 years old. That's impossible."
"I know. We're looking at a possible screw-up in the pipeline, the lab work. I'm checking that out tomorrow. But I also had to get a look at Pell, because until I learned from you he was a homosexual predator, he made the perfect suspect, if he had access to a time machine or something." The waiter came with their food and the soup in a container in a bag. Bosch said he'd take the check right away so he could pay and they'd be able to go as soon as they were finished eating.
"What do you want from me?" Stone asked when they were alone again.
"Nothing. What do you mean?"
"Are you hoping I'll reveal privileged information in exchange for half a turkey sandwich?"
Bosch couldn't tell if she was kidding or not. "No, I just thought there was just something I liked about you. I was out of line today, that's all." She was quiet for a long moment while she ate. He didn't push things. Bringing up his case seemed to put a freeze on everything.
"There's something there," she said. "That's all I can tell you."
"Look, don't compromise yourself. I pulled his files from probation and parole today. All his psychologicals will be in there." She smirked with her mouth full.
"You're talking about PSIs and parole evaluations. They only go skin deep."
Bosch put his hand up to stop her. "Look, Doc, this isn't about getting you to break a confidence. Let's talk about something else."
"Don't call me Doc."
"Sorry, Doctor."
"No, I mean just call me Hannah."
"Okay, Hannah. Hannah, let's talk about something else."
"Okay, what?"
Bosch was silent as he tried to think of something to go with. Soon they both started laughing, but they didn't mention Clayton Pell again.
Chapter 11. It was 9 o'clock when Bosch came through the front door. He hurried down the hall and looked in the open door of his daughter's bedroom. She was in bed under the covers with her laptop open next to her.
I'm so sorry, Maddie.
I'll heat this up and bring it in. Standing in the doorway, he proffered the bag from Jerry's.
It's all right, Dad. I already ate.
What did you eat?
PB&J.
Bosch felt the crushing guilt of selfishness. He came into the room and sat on the edge of the bed. Before he could apologize further, she once again let him off the hook.
It's okay. You got 2 new cases, and it was a busy day.
He shook his head. Nah, for the last hour I was just with somebody. I met her today on the case, but then she met me at Jerry's for a sandwich, and I stayed too long. Mads, I'm so...
God, that's even better. You actually met someone? Who is she?
Just somebody. She's a shrink who deals with criminals.
Cool. Is she pretty?
He noticed that she had her Facebook page up on her computer screen. We're just friends. Did you do any homework?
No, I didn't feel good.
I thought you said you were better.
Relapse City.
Look, you gotta go to school tomorrow. You've missed too much.
I know.
He didn't want to get into an argument. Hey, if you're not doing your homework, can I use your laptop for a little bit? I have to look at a disk.
Sure.
She reached over and closed out the screen. He went around the bed to where there was more room. He pulled the disk from the Chateau Marmont front desk security camera from his pocket and handed it to her. He wasn't sure how to get it to play. Maddie put the disk into a side slot and went through the commands to make it play. There was a timestamp in the lower corner of the screen, and Bosch told her to fast forward until she got to the time George Irving checked in. The image was clear, but was angled from an overhead camera, so Irving's face was not fully visible. Bosch had only watched the check-in part once and wanted to see it again.
So, what is this?
Maddie asked. Bosch pointed at the screen. The Chateau Marmont. This guy checking in. He goes up to his room on the 7th floor last night, and this morning he's found on the sidewalk below. I have to figure out if he jumped or if he got dropped. She stopped the playback.
If he was dropped, Dad, please. You sound like a palooka when you talk like that.
Sorry. How do you know what a palooka is anyway?
Tennessee Williams, I read. A palooka is an old fighter who's like a lout. You don't want to be like that.
You're right. But since you know so much about words, what do you call one of those names that are spelled the same going front and back?
What do you mean?
You know, like Otto or Hannah.
It's a palindrome. Is that your girlfriend's name?
She's not my girlfriend. I had a turkey sandwich with her.
Yeah, while your sick daughter was starving at home.
Come on, you had peanut butter and jelly, the best sandwich ever invented. He gently elbowed her side.
I just hope being with Otto was worth it.
He burst out laughing and reached over and pulled her into a hug. Don't worry about Otto. You'll always be my girl.
Well, I do like the name Hannah, she conceded.
Good. Can we watch now? She hit the play button, and they watched the computer screen silently as Irving began the check-in process with the night desk man, named Alberto Galvin. Soon the second guest appeared behind him, waiting to check in. Irving wore the same clothes Bosch had seen in the closet in the suite. He slid a credit card across the desk, and Galvin printed out the room contract. Irving quickly initialed and signed the document and slid it back in exchange for a key. He then left the camera's view in the direction of the elevators, and Galvin began the process all over again with the next guest in line. The video confirmed that Irving had checked in without luggage.
He jumped.
Bosch looked from the screen to his daughter.
Why do you say that?
Manipulating the controls, she backed the video up to the point where Galvin slid the contract across the desk to Irving. She then hit play.
"Watch," she said. "He doesn't even look at it. He just signs where the guy tells him to sign."
"Yeah, so?"
"This is when people check to see if they're getting ripped off. You know, they check what they are getting charged, but he doesn't even look. He doesn't care because he knows he'll never pay that bill."
Bosch watched the video. She was right about what she saw, but it wasn't conclusive. Still, he was proud of her read. He had noticed that her powers of observation were increasingly impressive. He often quizzed her on what she could remember from different places they had been to and scenes they had encountered. She always picked up and retained more than he expected. She had told him a year earlier that she wanted to be a cop when she grew up, a detective like him. He didn't know if it was just a passing idea, but he rolled with it and began passing on what he knew. One of their favorite things to do was to go to a restaurant like Dupar's and watch the other patrons and pour reeds off their faces and mannerisms. Bosch was teaching her to look for tells.
"That's a good read," he said. "Play it again."
They watched the video for the third time, and this time Bosch picked up something new. "You see that? He looks at his watch real quick there after he signs. So? What's time to a dead man? If he was going to jump, why would he wonder what time it was? It makes me think he was going to meet somebody, or someone was going to call, but no one did." Bosch had already checked with the hotel, and no call had gone in or out of Suite 79 after Irving checked in. He and Chu had also examined Irving's cell phone after returning to the PAB with the password his widow had provided. Irving had made no calls after a 5 p.m. call to his son, Chad. It had lasted 8 minutes. He had received 3 calls from his wife the following morning, after he was dead. By that time, Deborah Irving was looking for him. She left messages each time, telling her husband to call back. Bosch took over the controls of the video and played the check-in sequence once again. He then continued on, using the fast-forward control to move quickly through the chunks of time during the night when there was nothing happening at the front desk. His daughter eventually got bored and turned on her side to go to sleep.
"I might need to go out," he said to her. "You'll be okay?"
"Going back to see Hannah?"
"No, going back to the hotel. You'll be okay."
"Sure. I've got the Glock."
"Right."
The summer before, she had trained on a range, and Bosch considered her proficient in weapon safety and marksmanship. In fact, she was scheduled to compete for the first time the following weekend. More important than her skills with the gun was her understanding of the responsibility of the weapon. He hoped she would never use the weapon outside of a range. But if the time came, she'd be ready. He stayed on the bed next to her and continued to watch the video. He saw nothing on it that intrigued him or that he felt he had to follow up on. Finished with the disc, he got up quietly, turned out the light, and went out to the dining room. He was going to jump from the Irving case back to the Lily Price investigation. He opened his briefcase and spread out the files he had pulled that afternoon from the state's Department of Probation and Parole. Clayton Pell had 3 convictions on his record as an adult. They were sexually motivated crimes that escalated over the 10 years of his continued interaction with the justice system. He started at age 20 with indecent exposure, moved up to false imprisonment and indecent exposure at age 21, and then 3 years later hit the big time with the abduction and forcible rape of a minor below the age of 12. He got probation and county jail time for the first 2 convictions, but served 6 years out of a 10-year sentence at Corcoran State Prison for the 3rd fall. It was there that a barbaric justice was carried out by his fellow inmates. Bosch read through the details of the crimes. In each case, the victim was a boy aged 8 to 10 years old. The first victim was a neighbor's child. The second was a boy Pell had taken by the hand on a playground and led into a nearby restroom. The third crime involved lying in wait and more strategic planning. The victim was a boy who had gotten off a school bus and was walking home, a stretch of only 3 blocks, when Pell pulled up in his van and stopped. He told the boy he was with school security and showed him a badge. He said he needed to take the boy home because there had been an incident at school he had to inform his parents about. The boy complied and got in the van. Pell drove to a clearing and committed several sex acts upon the child in the van before releasing him and driving away. He did not leave DNA on the victim and was only caught because he blew through a red light after pulling out of the neighborhood. A camera took a picture of his van's license plate in the intersection just minutes before the boy was found wandering in a daze a few blocks away. Because of his past record, he became a suspect. The victim made an identification at a lineup, and the case was filed. But the ID, as with any made by a 9-year-old, was shaky, and Pell was offered a deal. He pleaded guilty and got a 10-year sentence. He probably felt he had gotten the better side of things until the day he was cornered in the laundry at Corcoran, held down, and castrated with a shank. With each conviction, Pell was psychologically evaluated as part of the PSI, or pre-sentence investigation. Bosch knew from experience that these tended to piggyback on each other. The evaluators were busy with a crushing caseload and often relied on the evaluation performed the first time. So Bosch paid careful attention to the PSI report from the first conviction for indecent exposure. The evaluation detailed a truly horrible and traumatic childhood. Pell was the son of a heroin-addicted mother who dragged the boy with her to dealer dens and shooting galleries, often paying for her drugs by performing sex acts on drug dealers right in front of her son. The child did not attend school with any regularity and had no real home that he could ever remember. He and his mother moved about constantly, living in hotels and motels, and with men who put up with them for short periods of time. Bosch keyed in on a long paragraph that described one particular stretch of time when Pell was 8 years old. He described for the evaluator an apartment where he lived for what he believed was the longest period of time he'd ever had under one roof. His mother had hooked up with a man named Johnny, who used her for sex and to buy drugs for him. Often the boy was left in Johnny's care, while his mother went out to sell sex in order to buy drugs. Sometimes she was gone for days, and Johnny became angry and frustrated. He alternately left the boy locked in a closet for long periods of time, or beat him brutally, often whipping him with a belt. The report noted that Pell still had the scars on his back and buttocks that supported the story. The beatings were horrible enough, but the man also took to sexually abusing the boy, forcing him to perform oral sex and threatening him with harsher beatings if he dared tell his mother or anyone else. Soon after, that situation ended when his mother moved on from Johnny. But the horrors of Pell's childhood veered in a new direction when he was 13 years old, and his mother overdosed on a motel bed while he was sleeping right next to her. He was taken into the custody of the Department of Children's Services and placed in a series of foster homes. But he never stayed in one place for long, choosing to run away whenever the opportunity presented itself. He told the evaluator that he had been living on his own since he was 17. When asked if he had ever held a job, he said the only thing he had ever been paid for was sex with older men. It was a gruesome story, and Bosch knew a version of it was shared by many of the denizens of the streets and the prisons, the traumas and depravities of childhood manifesting in adulthood, often in repetitive behavior. It was the mystery Hannah Stone said she investigated on a regular basis. Bosch checked the two other PSI reports and found variations of the same story, though some of Pell's recollections of the dates and ages shifted slightly. Still, it was largely the same story, and its repeated nature was either a testament to the laziness of the evaluators or to Pell's telling the truth. Bosch guessed that it was somewhere in the middle. The evaluators only reported what they had been told or copied it off a prior report. No effort had been made to confirm Pell's story or even to find the people who had abused him. Bosch took out his notebook and wrote down a summary of the story about the man named Johnny. He was now sure that there had been no screw-up in the handling of evidence. In the morning, he and Chu had an appointment at the regional lab, and at least Chu would keep it, if only to eventually be able to testify that they had exhaustively investigated all possibilities. But Bosch had no doubt that the lab was in the clear. He could feel the trickle of adrenaline dropping into his bloodstream. He knew it would soon become a relentless torrent, and he would move with its flow. He believed he now knew who killed Lily Price. Chapter 12. In the morning, Bosch called Chu from his car and told him to handle the visit to the crime lab without him. "But what are you doing?" his partner asked. "I have to go back to Panorama City. I'm checking out a lead." "What lead, Harry?" "It involves Pell. I read his file last night and came up with something. I need to check it. I don't think there's a problem at the lab, but we have to check it out in case it would ever come up at trial, if there ever is a trial. One of us has to be able to testify that we checked out the lab."
"So what do I tell them when I get there?"
"We have an appointment with the deputy director. Just tell her you need to double-check how the evidence from the case was handled. You interview the lab rat that ran the case, and that will be it. 20 minutes tops. Take notes."
"And what will you be doing?"
"Hopefully talking to Clayton Pell about a man named Johnny."
"What?"
"I'll tell you when I get back to the PAB. I gotta go." Bosch disconnected. He didn't want to get bogged down with explanations. That slowed things down. He wanted to keep his momentum. 20 minutes later, he was cruising Woodman, looking for a parking slot near the Buena Vista apartments. There was nothing, and he ended up parking on a red curb and walking a block back to the transition center. He reached through the gate to buzz the office. He identified himself and asked for Dr. Stone. The gate was unlocked, and he entered. Hannah Stone was waiting for him with a smile in the office suite's lobby area. He asked if she had her own office or a place they could speak privately, and she took him into one of the interview rooms.
"This will have to do," she said. "I share an office with two other therapists."
"What's going on, detective? I wasn't expecting to see you again so soon."
Bosch nodded, agreeing that he had thought the same thing. "Call me Harry. I want to talk to Clayton Pell." She frowned as though he was putting her into a difficult position.
"Well, Harry, if Clayton is a suspect, then you have put me in a very..."
"He's not. Look, can we sit down for a second?" She pointed him to what he assumed was the client-patient chair, while she took a chair facing it. "Okay," Bosch started. "First, I have to tell you that what I say here will probably sound too coincidental to be coincidence. In fact, I don't even believe in coincidence. But what we talked about last night at dinner hooked into what I did after dinner. And here I am. I need your help. I need to talk to Pell.
And it's not because he's a suspect."
"No, he was too young. We know he could not have killed Lily Price."
"He's a witness."
She shook her head.
"I've been talking to him 4 times a week for nearly 6 months. I think if he had witnessed this girl's murder, it would have come up on some level, subconscious or not."
Bosch held up his hands to stop her. "No, a material witness. He wasn't there and probably doesn't even know a thing about her. But I think he knew the killer.
He can help me. Here, just take a look at this. He opened his briefcase on the floor between his feet. He pulled out the original Lily Price murder book and quickly opened it to the plastic sleeves containing the faded Polaroid photos of the crime scene. Stone got up and came around to the side of his chair so she could look. Okay, these are really old and faded, but if you look at the victim's neck, you can make out the pattern left by the ligature. She was strangled. Bosch heard her sharp intake of breath. Oh my God, she said. He closed the binder quickly and looked up at her. She had brought one hand to her mouth. I'm sorry. I thought you were used to saying stuff like, I am. It's just that you never get used to it. My specialty is sexual deviancy and dysfunction. To see the ultimate. She pointed to the closed binder. That's what I try to stop. It's awful to see it. Bosch nodded, and she told him to go back to the photos. He opened the binder and returned to the plastic sleeves. He chose a close-up of the victim's neck and pointed out the vague indentation on Lily Price's skin. You see what I'm talking about? Yes, Stone said. Poor girl. Okay, now look at this one. He switched to a different Polaroid on the next sleeve and told her to once again look at the ligature pattern. There was a noticeable indentation in the skin. I see it, but what does it mean? The angle is different on this photo, and it shows the top line of the ligature. The first shot shows the lower line. He flipped the sleeve back and used his finger to outline the differences between the two shots. You see it? Yes, but I'm not following. You have two lines. What do they mean? Well, the lines don't match. They're on different levels of her neck. So it means that they are the top and bottom edges of the ligature. Take them together, and we get an idea of how wide the ligature was, and more importantly, what it was. Spacing his thumb and forefinger, he traced two lines on one of the photos, outlining a ligature that would have been almost 2 inches wide. It's all we have after so long, he said. The autopsy photos weren't in the archives file, so these photos are it, and they show that the ligature was at least 1.5 inches wide on the neck. Like a belt. Exactly. And then look at this. Right under the ear, we have another indentation, another pattern. He went to another photo in the second sleeve. It looks like a square. Right, like a square belt buckle. Now let's go to the blood. He flipped to the first sleeve and zeroed in on the first 3 Polaroids. They all showed shots of the blood smear on the victim's neck. Just one drop of blood that was smeared on her neck. It's right in the middle of the ligature pattern, meaning it could have been transferred from the ligature. 22 years ago, their theory was that the guy was cut and was bleeding, and a drop fell on her. He wiped it away, but left the smear. But you think it was a transfer? Right. It's the only explanation. And that's where Pell comes in. It was his blood, his 8-year-old blood, on her. How did it get there? Well, if we go with the transfer theory, it came off the belt. So the real question is not how did it get on Lily, it's how did it get on the belt. Bosch closed the binder and returned it to his briefcase. He pulled out the thick file from the Department of Probation and Parole. He held it up with 2 hands and shook it. Right here. I told you last night when you said you could not reveal client confidences that I already had his PSI evaluations. Well, I read them last night after I got home, and there's something here, and it ties in with your whole thing about repetitive behavior and... He was whipped with a belt. Bosch smiled. Careful, doctor. You don't want to be revealing confidences. Especially because you don't have to. It's all right here. Every time Pell got a psych evaluation, he told the same story.
When he was 8 years old, he and his mother lived with a guy who abused him physically and eventually sexually. It was probably what sent him down the path he's been on. But the physical abuse included being whipped with a belt. Bosch opened the file and handed her the first evaluation report. "He was whipped so hard he must have bled," he said. "That report says he had scars on his backside from the abuse. To leave a scar, you have to break the skin. You break the skin, and you get blood." He watched her as she scanned the report, her eyes fixed in concentration. He felt his phone vibrate, but ignored it. He knew it was probably his partner, reporting that he had completed the DNA lab visit. "Johnny," she said as she handed the report back. Bosch nodded. "I think he's our man, and I need to talk to Pell to get a line on him. Has he ever told you his full name? In the PSIs, he only calls him Johnny." "No, he just called him Johnny in our sessions, too. That's why I need to talk to him." She paused as she considered something Bosch apparently hadn't thought of. He thought she would be as excited about the lead as he was.
"What?"
"Harry, I have to consider what this will do to him, dredging all of this up. I'm sorry, but I have to consider his well-being before the well-being of your investigation."
Bosch wished she hadn't said that.
"Wait a minute," he said. "What do you mean, dredging it up? It's in all three of his psych reports here. He has to have talked to you about this guy. I'm not asking you to break that confidence. I want to talk directly to him."
"I know, and I can't stop you from talking to him. It's really his option. He'll talk to you or he won't. But my only worry is that he's quite fragile, as you can..."
"You can get him to talk to me, Hannah. You can tell him it will help him."
"You mean lie to him? I won't do that."
Bosch stood up, since she had not returned to her seat.
"I don't mean lie. I mean tell the truth. This will help him to get this guy out of the shadows of the past, like an exorcism. Maybe he even knows that this guy was killing girls."
"You mean there's more than one?"
"I don't know, but you saw the photos. It doesn't look like a one-time thing, like, oh, I got that out of my system and it's back to being a citizen again. This was a predator's crime, and predators don't stop. You know that as well as I do. It doesn't matter if this happened 22 years ago. If this guy Johnny is still out there, I have to find him. And Clayton Pell is the key."
Chapter 13. Clayton Pell agreed to talk to Bosch, but only if Dr. Stone remained present. Harry had no problem with that and thought that having Stone on hand might be helpful during the interview. He only cautioned her that Pell might become a witness in an eventual trial, and as such, Bosch would conduct the interview in a methodical and linear fashion. An orderly walked Pell into the interview room, where three chairs had been set up, one facing the other two. Bosch introduced himself and shook Pell's hand without hesitation. Pell was a small man, no more than 5'2" and 110 pounds, and Bosch knew that victims of sexual abuse during childhood often suffered from stunted growth. Bosch pointed Pell to his seat and cordially asked if he needed anything.
"I could use a smoke," Pell said.
When he sat, he brought his legs up and crossed them on the seat. It seemed like a childlike thing to do.
"I could use one too, but we're not going to break the rules today," Bosch said.
"That's too bad then."
Stone had suggested that they set the three seats up around a table to make it less formal, but Bosch had said no. He also choreographed the seating arrangement so that both he and Stone would be left and right of Pell's center view line, which would mean he would have to constantly look back and forth between them. Observing eye movement would be a good way for Bosch to measure sincerity and veracity. Pell had become a tragic figure in Stone's estimation, but Bosch held no such sympathy. Pell's traumatic history and childlike dimensions didn't matter. He was now a predator. Just ask the 9-year-old boy he had pulled into his van. Bosch planned to constantly remind himself that predators hid themselves, and that they lied and waited for their opponents to reveal weaknesses. He wouldn't make a mistake with Pell.
"Why don't we get started here?" Bosch said. "If you don't mind, I will take written notes as we talk."
"All right by me," Pell said.
Bosch pulled out his notebook. It had an LAPD detective's badge embossed on its leather cover. It had been a gift from his daughter, who had it custom-made through a friend in Hong Kong, whose father was in the leather business. The embossing was complete with his badge number, 2997. She had given it to him at Christmas. It was one of his most treasured possessions because it had come from her, but also because he knew it served a valuable purpose. Every time he flipped it open to jot down a note, he was showing the badge to his interview subjects and reminding them that the power and might of the state was before them.
"So what's this about?"
Pell asked in a high nasal voice.
"Doc didn't tell me nothing about nothing."
Stone did not tell him not to call her Doc. "It's about a murder, Clayton," Bosch said. "From way back when you were just a boy of 8 years old."
"I don't know nothing about no murder, sir."
The voice was grating, and Bosch wondered if it had always been that way, or was the byproduct of the prison attack. "I know that. And you should know that you are not suspected in this crime in any way."
"Then why come to me?"
"Good question, and I'm going to just answer it straight, Clayton. You are in this room because your blood and your DNA were found on the victim's body." Pell shot straight up out of his chair.
"Okay, I'm out of here."
He turned to head toward the door.
"Clay,"
Stone called out. "Hear him out. You are not a suspect. You were 8 years old. He just wants to know what you know. Please." He looked down at her, but pointed at Bosch.
"You can trust this guy, but I don't. The cops don't do anybody any favors, only themselves."
Stone stood up to make her pitch. "Clayton, please, give it a chance." Pell reluctantly sat back down. Stone followed, and he stared at her while refusing to look at Bosch. "We think the killer had your blood on him," Bosch said, "and it somehow got transferred to the victim. We don't think you had anything to do with the crime."
"Why don't you just get it over with?"
he replied, holding his wrists out and together for cuffing.
"Clay, please," Stone said.
He waved both hands in an enough already gesture. He was small enough that he could completely turn his body in his seat and put both legs over the chair's left arm, giving Bosch the cold shoulder, like a child ignoring his parent. He folded his arms across his chest, and Bosch could see the top edge of a tattoo peeking out of his collar on the back of his neck.
"Clayton," Stone said sternly, "don't you remember where you were when you were 8? Don't you remember what you've told me over and over?"
Pell tucked his chin down toward his chest and then relented.
"Of course I do."
"Then answer Detective Bosch's questions."
He milked it for 10 seconds and then nodded.
"Okay. What?"
Just as Bosch was about to ask a question, his phone buzzed in his pocket. Pell heard it.
"If you answer that, I'm fucking walking out of here."
"Don't worry, I hate cell phones." Bosch waited for the buzzing to stop and then proceeded. "Tell me about where you were and how you were living when you were 8 years old, Clayton." Pell turned back straight in his chair to face Bosch.
"I was living with a monster, a guy who liked to beat the shit out of me.